Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. And Mr. Ramsland did this because he said, and I quote, the subset of a large retail market anchor department stores have general land values characteristics very different from the other mall sites or even from big box retail land parcels. And yet, what did he do when he looked at his land values in this case? What did he use to support his land values? And this was a land value that was accepted by the BTA. He used two big box land sales, Walmart land sales. This is totally inconsistent between his highest and best use and what he's using to support the land sales that became the basis of the land derivation by the BTA.
One of the things Mr. Smith talked about was the multi-use stores.
Yes.
I don't know exactly the term he used, but he used the example of the store in Akron, I believe, that was Dillard's on the top and several other things on the bottom.
That's correct.
But I didn't see any evidence that that was going to bring more money or, you know, that that was a higher use.
The evidence was in two things, Your Honor. One, it created a larger market. Two, the rents were higher for the big box and the multi-tenant stores than they were with the quote-unquote full anchor department stores.
But he didn't, you know, he brought up this example on Akron, and the other examples he brought up, it seemed to me, that were in situations where the malls were going downhill. You know, I have a hard time believing that they'd be worth more than, I think there was another one of the Cleveland shopping centers that claimed it had done something like that. But it sounded like these were shopping centers that were on the downhill slide, so we converted to try and keep them full to multi-tenant.
In some instances, that's true, and I'd have to say in a majority instances is true, but that whole process is evolving. For instance, in Westgate, which was quoted in his brief, Kohl's came in there right from the start. At that time, it was not a struggling mall. The instances he pointed out in California and the instances, in fact, referred to in Mr. Wilhelmy's were not, Mr. Ramsland's appraisal report were not struggling malls. So there's no doubt that it's used more often in the struggling mall concept, but that's not
so
true universally.
How is that a highest and best use?
Pardon me?
A highest and best use, I mean, how do we know dollar-wise that that's going to be a higher and best use?
Because traditionally, the Walmarts and the Targets and these outfits that come in pay higher rents. And that's one of the items that drive, as noted in all the appraisers' reports, the value of those parcels is the types of rents that they can get on those parcels.
But they're not in, we don't see a Walmart in a major mall, super regional mall like this, do we?
We do now. Parmatown was one of the ones that were mentioned in here. They're coming all the time, and it's the trend, and it's a trend that started back in the late 90s, and I agree, is building momentum, and we're going to see it more and more and more.
Well, they may be near, but are they actually connected to the mall?
Absolutely. Okay. Walmart's connected to Parmatown. Kohl's is connected to Westgate. Yes, they are.
Are these up-and-coming malls, or are these, I don't know anything about
them. Yeah, Parmatown is been around for a while. It went through a remake. Westgate is too. Summit County, we saw it there at in Summit County Mall in Akron.
That brings up the next question is, the encumbrance, the fact that there's a disagreement with the mall owner. I'm assuming that's part and parcel of getting the land for $10.
Yes.
You have to enter an agreement to have this. Highest and best use talks about government or easements and
right.
All this thing. What do we do about that?
I think clearly under this court's pronouncements, we can't look at private covenants and deed restrictions. It's right in the pronouncement of this court that you consider government restrictions, such as zoning, a cheat, eminent domain. You cannot consider. The property has to be valued as if it's unencumbered. And as a practical matter, I can see why. Because what happens with this, with Dillard's, if one of the let's say Dillard's is going bad, the other stores, they aren't going to block it. They're changed all the time. Covenants and deeds are changed all the times to permit this. So there's a practical reason besides the legal reason why we don't consider those private covenants and deed restrictions. The second thing I'd like to point out in the land sales areas is Mr. Ramsland readily admits that the land sales are very locally driven. And yet again, what he picks for his comps are three properties in Nebraska and New Jersey. In his own testimony, he was the one who said these values for land particularly vary widely. The third item then is he takes in his comparable land sales, they aren't comparables at all. He takes leases and he applies a cap rate that the BTA rejected. This was the sole basis of his land sales, these three items. None of them are reliable for the reasons that I've stated.
I mean, this is a case where when you start this land sale, there isn't any exact comparable. Doesn't the board have to sort of weigh that and come up?
It does, but it has to weigh it based on the evidence that's in the record. You can't have a highest and best use of full anchors and then use Walmart stores as your land comp. You can't say that the values are locally driven and then use sales from Nebraska and New Jersey. Mr. Smith, in his opinion, his highest and best use was full anchor department stores, Walmart's, Targets. His land sales that he used were consistent with his highest and best use. The second major substantive issue was Mr. Ramsland basically did a value in use as opposed to a value in exchange appraisal. That's contrary to this court's opinion in the Park Investment case that interprets Article 12, Section 2 of our Constitution. In fact, I'd ask you to note on page 25 of his report, he says full anchor department stores are value in use. He may feel that way for his own appraisal purposes, but that's certainly contrary to the law here in Ohio. In his cost approach, which is the basis for the decision here, Mr. Ramsland used a value, but then he lops off a full year of depreciation for a two-month-old building. He lops off $3.5 million for functional obsolescence, and then he lops off $5.5 million for economic obsolescence. I believe the BTA, and I address this because it's part of their cross appeal, correctly handled the functional obsolescence. The design and trade dress of Kaufman's, which is in the same shopping center in Penny's, is close to the same thing. The size is the same size as the other Dillard stores that are out there, and the newest Dillard store that they constructed in North Olmsted is the same size. There's no evidence of functional obsolescence. You're talking about a box that's the same as every other box there. On the economic obsolescence, again, it's based on sales from the property. You got a property that's 2 months old. You got a property that all three appraisers says hasn't hit its stride yet. It's at least five.
Your argument basically is another operator could have come in there, done bang up business. We wouldn't have any economic.
Absolutely. Kaufman's is doing so much more per square foot that's in the record. They're just another department store.
Right.
You can't base your economic obsolescence on sales because there's too many other factors. There's the marketing, there's the advertising, there's the sales help, there's the category mix in what you have there. And then they try to compare it across the country. You can't compare across the country sales from Northeast Ohio. This particular store was the third store of 30 in Ohio. Thank you.
Your time. Mr. Wilhelmini.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Tom Wilhelmini. I'm appearing this morning as counsel for Appellee and Cross Appellant Higbee Company. I'm appearing pursuant to Higbee's motion that I appear pro hoc vitae, which was granted by this court. As cross-appellant pursuant to Section 5 of Rule 9 of the practice rules of this court, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. I will first address the arguments made by my colleague.
Quite light, but come on in 2 minutes.
Yes, thank you. First of all, let me emphasize that appellant's proposition number one is factually unsound. Evidence Rule 612 applies if the witness uses the documents to refresh the memory. I believe the record is eminently clear, as found by the hearing examiner, that these documents were not used to refresh the witness's memory. Second of all,
the testimony's a little, you know, they're a little shaky there at the actual testimony, and then of course it seems like the board said no in the final decision. Is that correct?
Well, I believe the confusion is whether he took them to the witness stand, which is clearly acknowledged, or whether he used them. And I believe that the hearing examiner, who was there in the courtroom, heard the testimony and saw the documents and reviewed them in camera, concluded that he had not relied upon these documents. To the extent that they were relied upon, they were already in the record. These documents are 4 pages, which were advice of counsel to the witness. They clearly fall under the attorney-client privilege and the attorney work product standard. And the hearing examiner, who was right there to observe, concluded that they were not used to refresh the witness's recollection.
But if they were used, then they would have been open.
If the hearing examiner had concluded that they were used, then I'm quite certain that she would have allowed counsel to look at those documents.
Okay.
The next point is proposition number 2. Under the West Haven decision, the board has substantial discretion to admit and weigh evidence. There is no evidence here that the witness relied upon the documents in exhibits 10 through 19. More importantly, there is no indication whatsoever there's any impact on the actual decision by the board. I will move quickly. Looking to appellant's proposition of law number 7, this is the highest and best use issue. This, we believe, is a false claim because it ignores the reality of how department stores are characterized and recognized in the industry. One of the pieces of evidence in the record is Exhibit Q. That's a publication of the Urban Land Institute, a recognized repository and publisher of information. That page Q specifically recognized that discount department stores such as Kmart and Walmart are not considered full-line department stores. And there's good reason for that. For one thing, Kmarts and Walmarts are not built on 2 or 3 levels, creating different economies of construction, different economies of scale.
What do we
costs.
Do about this situation where the reason, theoretically, I guess, that a Kmart or Walmart couldn't come in there, assuming that the landowner, well, that Jacobs would let them somehow. What do we do about this encumbrance? Doesn't the highest and best use, isn't that, you know, government encumbrances you look at? You don't look at private deals?
In looking at the legally permissible facet of the highest and best use requirement, my experience is that courts both in Ohio and in other states are looking at legally permissible from a broader sense, both looking at government restrictions and also looking at private restrictions. This is not a deed
We've
restriction.
We've ignored private restrictions.
Pardon me?
We've usually ignored private restrictions, I believe.
Private restrictions are ordinarily ignored, but not in the case of reciprocal easement and operating agreements in a shopping center. This is a new facet that's been focusing on. In this case, Jacobs, a private landowner, made the decision that the highest return to him and to the property would be if the store was occupied as an anchor department store. As counsel pointed out, it was only open for 2 or 3 months before the assessment date. There was a determination by Jacobs, a highly regarded developer, that this was the highest and best use, the highest return to the property. The legally permissible is just one of the facets. In addition, there is no indication anywhere that Kmarts or Walmarts occupy a 211,000 square foot store on 2 or 3 levels. That is a physical reality that pretty much excludes the Walmarts and the Kmarts from being valid comparables. This physical dissimilarity was an issue that Mr. Smith, the expert witness for the appellant, consistently disregarded in the course of his testimony.
I think he overcomes that, doesn't he, by saying we're going to have Dillard's on the top floor and we're going to have somebody else on the next floor.
He circumvents that question by doing it, but his appraiser report does not include any cost of converting the space into multi-tenant with different levels and perhaps different tenancies in a single space. In addition, he specifically opines that in his opinion, there is no difference in the value of the property, whether it's a department store or a multi-tenant retail facility. So therefore, he has taken this whole issue right out of contention. His appraisal and his opinion literally takes the highest and best use argument right away from the appellant in this case.
What do we do about the land value? That question bothers me. It didn't seem like anybody handled it real well.
Well, The reason that there are some issues and some discomfort is because the market does not provide us with evidence. There are not a series of large department store parcels. There's not even large shopping center parcels from which to look at. Mr. Ramsland did the best he could with the best available information, and the board recognized that he looked at the large retail tracts that were available. He looked at department store information from ground leases. He used the market information. Appraisers and the board cannot just conjure up evidence to support their opinions. They have to deal with the market evidence that's available.
What if the $10 and other good and valuable consideration, I assume that's what the deed said, something similar to that. What if this court were to come down and say, well, willing buyer, willing seller? You think it's really $10 for that 15 acres?
I think that the fee simple market value of that land is worth more than $10. I think the $10 is a genuine number. It is in the record. It is what is actually paid. It is part of the negotiations between the developer and the shopping center. It is not the position of Dillard's that the land is only worth $10. Dillard's is the Higbee company for these purposes.
Let's go talk about economic obsolescence a little bit.
Economic obsolescence, we believe, is the most significant issue in this case. The board recognized that if Mr. Ramsland's analysis is adjusted to remove functional obsolescence, that his analysis is reliable. The issue in this case is how does one remove functional obsolescence if you decide to agree with Mr. Ramsland? The board just took a lump sum dollar amount and added it back. And we believe that is fundamentally an error. It is conceptually a disregard of the appraisal standards as set forth in the textbook, the 12th edition of the appraisal of real estate. Economic obsolescence is a calculation by which the actual expected market return of the property fails to match up with the cost of construction. Mr. Ramsland carefully laid out his analysis, looking at the replacement cost new, backing out physical depreciation and then functional obsolescence, and then calculated economic.
Doesn't that get into what Mr. Colic argues, though, that we're looking at the use of the property rather than the property?
No, we're looking at what the highest and best use of the property is, and it's recognized in the appraisal profession.
Let's say that Dillard's had done, they predicted $140-some a square foot. What if they would have done that?
If they would have done that, Mr. Ramsland's analysis would not have calculated economic obsolescence.
So the I conceptually have a problem that this building, because the tenant does more business in it, is worth more than if the tenant does less business.
Well, that's really not the focus. The issue is what is the level of market rent? And Mr. Ramsland recognized that the level of retail sales is one of the indicia that department store operators, whether they be owners or tenants, look at to measure the demographics in the area. It recognizes that consumer retail transactions are daily market transactions that measure the strength of the trade area. Dillard's is a recognized national operator. They've generated a certain level of sales, but that's only one of the factors looked at by Mr. Ramsland in determining the level of market rent. He also looks at department store leases. He looks at all available information from the market in opining to what the level of market rent would be.
Most of those leases had a, I guess you call an overage on them. And there again, the tenant's success would determine the rent.
Not the tenant's success, but the strength of the market, the trade area in which the store is located. The presumption followed by department store operators is that this is a measure of the strength of the trade area. It is just one of the factors that is looked at.
That's true, but doesn't it also seem possible that another tenant could have come in there, say you had a Nordstrom's. I'm not saying they're going to do better than Dillard's, but let's say that they drew better. The testimony sometimes I notice used Nordstrom's that they're obviously a very desired anchor tenant. And if they come in and they do more per square foot, using that as a measure, then you would say this building is worth more.
The original projections by Dillard's were based upon what Dillard's would expect to perform in the location. We're setting a proportionality between Dillard's expectations locally and nationally for the store and Dillard's operation. for Nordstrom to come in puts in a different set of proportionalities. If Nordstrom's came in and had certain expectations, then we would look at the Nordstrom's operation to see how...
Shouldn't we be looking at their expectations, though? I mean, let's say Dillard's came in and Dillard said, we predict $100 a square foot, and we did, it was 104, 106, or something like that, and then it went up a little bit there for a year or two. And that exceeded their expectations. Should the building be worth more then?
Well, to the extent that it exceeded expectations, then I would suspect that the board would have given more weight to the income approach. And the income approach would recognize that the level of performance was exceeding the expectations at the time of going in. It is in this case, because of the poor performance of the store and the failure to measure up, that they looked essentially at the cost approach. The level of sales is only viewed as a way of quantifying the demographic strength of the trade
and
area.
It seems that as a practicality that apparently that's the way these stores are bought and sold in the trade.
That is the conclusive evidence in this case. Mr. Benton had appraised some 100 Danker department stores, Mr. Ramsden between 100 and 150. That substantial body of experience tells the board that this is the way department store operators operate. As you noted, overage is the key factor. You cannot determine the level of rent under the lease without looking at the level of sales. Sales are integrally related to the determination of what market rent is. I'd like to turn now to the issues that are raised by the cross appeal. The determination that there is no functional obsolescence in this case is a departure from accepted appraisal practices. Let's look quickly at what the findings were in this case and what the textbook definition is. We're talking about super adequacy. We're talking about ways in which the structure, its size, or its methods or design exceeds market norms. Mr. Ramsland identified two factors, size and the level of interior finish or trade dress. The size of the subject property is 23% larger than the other three anchors in the mall, a significant disparity as applied to the same trade area. That's the size store that Dillard's builds. It was not custom fit to this market. That store operates at a low level of sales. It is not a coincidence that if one were to apply the same total level of retail sales to a correctly sized store for the strength of the trade area, that you would end up with a level of sales that was more consistent with their expectations.
I have a little trouble with that. What if they were to shut off 50,000 square feet? Would their sales go up?
That's an outstanding point. The issue is what would a prudent buyer or tenant pay for? And what they would pay for is based upon market norms. A prudent buyer or tenant operates a store that's 23% smaller. And our evidence of that is Sears and Penney's and Kaufman's. So they would not lease space that they're not going to use.
You're not really competing, are you, in the same market as Sears and Penney's?
No, but we're competing in the same trade area and against the same competition. So the trade area should define the size of the store. Dillard's did not tailor the store to the trade area, therefore its store was too large. If a tenant looking to lease the property would lease the space based on market norms, that's the fundamental concept of superadequacy.
Don't we again have this problem that another operator could come in there and that would be a fine space for them?
We have no evidence in the record that another operator would come in and want to use 211,000 square feet. The market evidence is that the market norm, not that there may be some isolated exception, but what is the market norm? That's the fundamental basis for superadequacy. The market norm is a size 23% smaller. This is a physical fact, and both of the experts that were recognized by the board as credible identify this as a key factor. The findings that are in error quickly as follows. All three experts did not testify that this was a typical department store. In fact, counsel himself in his opening statement commented that the Dillard's is the largest and most ornate. Second of all, they did not have similar levels of trade dress. There were very different. There was a significant difference in marble, in levels of wood and finishing. Third, the issue is what would a prudent buyer or prudent tenant pay for? And finally, the relatively new status is a non-factor. The new status in the textbook is recognized that you can have functional obsolescence before construction is even completed. I see that my time is up.
Okay, yeah, thank you. You have some rebuttal time.
Yes, I do.
Okay. Mr. Kolick, you have 47 seconds.
47 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just in rebuttal then, first of all, the hearing examiner never said that he didn't use documents. The quote from the record was on Supplement Volume 2, page 458. He was testifying from some of those documents. Unfortunately, we don't know which ones. That's the best statement. Your Honor, the law in Ohio on the encumbrances is clear. Mirfield Association versus Franklin County Board of Revision. It is established law in Ohio that the taxable value of real property means the value of the fee simple estate unencumbered by any private restrictions entered into by interested parties. Your Honor, I think you hit the nail on the head when we talk about economic obsolescence. Just because what Higbee's projected they may do, shoot, they'd be able to control their own values by putting it low or putting it high to where they want to go. You're talking about an established department store who built a store. Yeah, one of the stores have to be the largest in the mall. I mean, it's just going to be. Anyone that's coming in there to buy that property is going to look at what they can do from it. They'll be concerned historically, but they'll look at what they can do. Your Honor, we would respectfully request that the court reverse the decision of the BTA. Thank you,
Mr. Culler. Mr. Wilmy.
Yes, I'll just briefly respond.
I'll give you a minute.
Thank you very much. The issue of economic obsolescence is a key issue in this case. The level of performance by Dillard's would be looked at by any other operator who came in to determine the strength of the trade area. That is a recognized technique or method applied by appraisers who value department stores. Mr. Smith's testimony was thoroughly discredited, dissected, and rejected. His testimony was recognized as not being a credible statement of what appraisers who value department stores do or what department stores do when they buy or lease their own stores. In this case here, the board properly excluded his testimony, and it should not have any influence on any of the issues in this case. He has indicated a disdain for the appraisal profession and what the standards are.
A little strong for his testimony.
To say that people who publish articles in the appraisal journal are a bunch of, they issue wacky decisions to build their own resumes, that's a bit of a sarcastic comment by Mr. Smith on it. We believe that the issue was clear. It's not a question of business value, it's a question of what is the financial, economic information available to measure the strength of the trade area, and that's what department stores look at.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Case will be submitted. Case will be submitted. Case will be submitted. Case will